Hi, and welcome to the second episode of Offensive Shadows.
Your 15 minutes with a broad, her bud, and the bard.
I'm Mike.
I'm Danny.
And we are continuing on with Act 2 of the lamentable tragedy of Titus Andronicus. Act 2 opens with the day after in Rome. Aaron the Moor is alone, speaking about how high Tamora's fortunes have come since they were marched into Rome. She has gone from prisoner to now Empress of Rome. And he's commenting about how his fortunes will rise with her.
And here we see the typical Shakespearean villain soliloquy. We're going to see it again with Iago and Richard III. You know, now is the winter, or what's he then that it calls me a villain? We get Shakespeare really likes to show us the inside of his villains' heads, and it's something I think that a lot of us really appreciate about his canon.
Once Aaron has finished his speech, enter Chiron and Demetrius, Tamora's two remaining sons, talking about who else but the woman everyone wants in Rome, Lavinia. They're arguing back and forth about how they will seduce her and how one will beat out the other to get her. And Aaron steps in and says, "You're Goths. She's not going to be interested in you. She's not going to marry you. You can't seduce her. Instead, why don't you kidnap her, and then you can both have her by raping her." This is kind of brutal. They, being evil, of course, think this is a brilliant idea.
This is a very typical lair of evil scene with the bad guys sort of laying out their plan. And we don't get a lot of bad guy groups in Shakespeare. We do get it again in Much Ado About Nothing. But we can definitely see the young Shakespeare developing his grace with the evil characters. The brothers are the big lunkheads, and Aaron's the crafty evil guy. And of course, we're going to see it again, like I said, in Iago, but also in Giacomo, in Cymbeline.
We close the scene with the brothers thinking that this is a brilliant idea, and we move on to Act 2.
Scene 2.
We move on from Scene 1 to Scene 2. Scene 2 moves from Rome to the woods, and we have all the court gathered here. They are prepping for the great hunt that Titus is called. Titus is here waiting for the emperor to arrive, and when he arrives, the emperor, he is commenting about how he's still tired from the night of reveling, the celebration from his marriage last night to Tamora. There's some dialogue back and forth. Lavinia, of course, says that she had been up for 2 hours before everyone else. And then the entire court splits up for the hunt. This is important because now people are going their separate ways.
And this is pretty emblematic of what's going on here. The hunt in Shakespeare is always going to symbolize exactly what you would think it does, which is hunting down a helpless thing. In this case, we're a little bit more literal than usual. Sometimes we'll be talking about the hunt in terms of metaphor, i.e. love, like in As You Like It, A Midsummer Night's Dream, that sort of thing. But here we're actually talking about hunting down helpless things and killing it, like the Edgar Allan Poe story.
We move on to Scene 3. We're still in the woods with the hunt, and we are back to Aaron, and Aaron is starting out to enact his cunning plan for vengeance. Aaron is hiding a bag of gold under a tree, and he is met by Tamora, who is looking for an illicit hookup out in the woods with Aaron, since the emperor is now off in the woods hunting. Aaron says he doesn't have time for it because he's been plotting revenge, and he explains his plan to Tamora to kill Bassianus.
And Tamora and Aaron are probably one of the most well-matched pairs in all of Shakespeare. We're not very used to seeing Shakespearean lovers who are good for each other, but they're pretty much the Beatrice and Benedict of evil.
That's actually a pretty good comparison, in fact. As Aaron is explaining his plan to Tamora, and Tamora is still pressing her case, trying to get Aaron to concede and run off for at least a quick tryst, enter Bassianus and Lavinia. They catch Tamora and Aaron in the act, and they are very much aware of exactly what Tamora is trying to do. They mock Tamora not only for being an adulteress, but for choosing Aaron, and they tell Tamora that they're going to run off and tell the emperor. Aaron, as soon as they showed up, took off and went to get Chiron and Demetrius. While Tamora delays Bassianus and Lavinia, Chiron and Demetrius show up, and Tamora tells them a sympathetic story about how Bassianus and Lavinia have been threatening her, and they threatened to throw her into a pit. The boys, ever ready to defend her mother, kill Bassianus immediately. Tamara is about to kill Lavinia, but the boys ask her to hold first and explain that they have other plans for her. Tamara, not particularly interested in showing mercy to one of Titus's family, agrees and hands the girl over to her sons. Lavinia attempts to plead her case and plead mercy with Tamara, saying that you're a woman too. Please do not leave me with these savages. But Tamara says that Titus showed my son no mercy. I'm going to show his daughter none also.
We really get down and dirty fast in this play. This play goes dark quickly. We're only in Act 2, and we're already seeing some pretty heinous acts. And in addition, in that Tamara speech, we also see her being a wordsmith, very eloquent and crafty with her words, which is really how she's able to navigate through this the rest of the play. And Tamara is the first example we have of a woman who's able to navigate a man's world through the use of her words. And it's always words in Shakespeare that are the most powerful force. So she has the most power in the play because she's able to wrap all these men to do her bidding through the use of her rhetoric.
Chiron and Demetrius chuck Bassianus' body into the pit, and the boys drag off Lavinia offstage to have their way with her. Aaron has returned again, bringing Quintus and Martius to the pit, saying that he found a panther for them to kill. Quintus and Martius are Titus's other two sons, and investigating the pit, Martius falls in and finds the body of Bassianus. Quintus, trying to recover his brother, also falls in. And Aaron goes to get the court.
This whole bit with the pit is another reason why theater companies don't really do this show. As I explained in the first episode, Shakespeare's stage had a convenient trapdoor to fall into, which could be used as a pit, but modern theaters, and especially low-budget houses or outdoor theaters where Shakespeare is prevalent, just don't have the space for this kind of thing.
The emperor arrives with the rest of the court and tries to figure out why his brother is dead and why the only two people with his body are Quintus and Martius. Tamara conveniently produces a fake letter that details a plan to kill Bassianus. Saturninus immediately concludes that the people responsible for the letter are Andronicus' family. Titus, who is there, asks for a trial, begs for a trial from the emperor, but Saturninus denies it. He doesn't even allow Quintus and Martius to plead their case. He announces that everyone will return to Rome, where he will execute the two boys.
And of course here we have a whole series of scenes that take place in the woods. The woods is another theme we're going to see pop up again and again in Shakespeare. And the woods is that place away from the court where you can be someone that you're not. You can perform acts that you would not perform in court. So all these murders and deaths and egregious acts are performed outside of the Crystal Palace of Rome. There's no blood on the granite stairs, you know?
There's the end of scene 3. We'll move on to scene 4. And scene 4 opens with Chiron and Demetrius and Lavinia. They have pretty much finished tormenting the poor girl. And we find that they have cut out Lavinia's tongue and cut off her hands so that she's unable to identify them. The scene starts with them mocking her, and then they flee off. Shortly after, Marcus Andronicus, Titus' brother, enters the scene and finds his niece has been assaulted.
So, this is one of the most difficult speeches in Shakespeare to give. First of all, Marcus walks on and delivers a 47-line speech. 47 lines! This is in the top 5 longest speeches in the canon. I mean, you've got Aegeon's speech in Comedy of Errors, which is 64 lines, then another 22 right after that. Canterbury's speech in Henry V, which is 63 lines. Or Berune's speech in Love, Labor's Lost, which is 54 lines. 47 lines of Marcus just standing there, looking at Lavinia and describing what he sees. Usually this bit gets shaved down quite a bit in performance because who, when presented with the image of one's ravished niece with her hands and tongue cut out, bleeding to death before you, delivers a 47-line speech? And it's not even an active speech. He can't do anything. He's just standing there looking at her. So there's this human element of shock and being frozen, but at the same time, it's like, I always wonder at the fortitude of these characters. How much blood do they have in their bodies that they can stand there bleeding while somebody delivers a 47-line speech?
Yeah, this is one of the few places in the play where I think it tends to drag a little, and I think definitely for modern audiences, cutting this down to from 47 lines to maybe 5 may not be a bad idea. And that is the end of Act 2. We're going to move on immediately to Act 3. And in Scene 1, the court has returned to Rome. It starts with Titus outside of the Roman Senate. And the judges and tribunes of Rome are leading off his sons for execution. And they are completely ignoring all of Titus's pleas for mercy, for justice, for them to spare his sons. After all the tribunes of Rome and the judges step off stage, Titus, in fact, continues to plead to no one until Lucius enters, having been banished for attempting to free his brother during the trial. He finds his father, Titus, still pleading his case to the stones of the Senate steps. Lucius is starting to wonder about his father and asks him, why are you pleading your case to the stones? There's no one here. And Titus says it hardly matters. There's no one to listen.
And this is the first time we see Titus maybe acting contrary to how a normal person would act. Just sort of the seeds of that madness that we're going to get full tilt in the coming acts.
To add insult to injury, or to add upon the tragedy, Marcus now brings in Titus's daughter Lavinia, and Lucius is just absolutely horrified as what has happened to his sister. They try and get Lavinia to communicate what happened to her, and Titus believes he's able to understand a few things, but nobody's entirely sure what happened. The scene is pretty much revolves around Lavinia attempting to communicate and their frustration with being unable to understand what happened.
And when you see this on stage, you have this woman just completely destroyed and these men surrounding her who hold the power, and this communication barrier between them is very emblematic, actually, of male-female relationships, wouldn't you say?
You could definitely say that. Into this steps Aaron, always wanting to throw more tragedy onto the situation. Aaron steps in and says that Saturninus has decided that he will pardon Titus' sons if one of the Andronicus family will offer up a hand as tribute. Quite literally, cut off their own hand and offer it up to the emperor. The family then starts getting into a dispute as to who will actually offer up the hand.
And at this point, we're in the belly of the beast, right? We have Lavinia's been ravished. We're talking about cutting off hands. Things can't really go much further downhill for our heroes.
So Lucius, Marcus, and Titus all debate on who's going to offer up the hand. Titus is quite firm in that, saying he's going to do it. He's going to do it. But he then backs down and turns to Marcus and Lucius and says, all right, I will acquiesce to your wishes. Go find an axe and we'll choose either one of you. Marcus and Lucius go off to look for an axe. Titus then immediately turns to Aaron and says, cut my hand off. And Aaron does. Titus gives the hand to Aaron and says, deliver this to the emperor for my sons. Aaron does and exits with the hand. Lucius and Marcus return with the axe to find that Titus has chopped his own hand off. They mourn Titus's loss until a messenger arrives, and the messenger is bringing back Titus's hand, but he also brings back the heads of Quintus and Martius, Titus's two sons. They collect the heads. Titus tells Lavinia to collect his hand, Titus's hand, in her teeth, and tells Marcus to take one of the heads. Titus takes the other head. And then Titus turns to Lucius and says, you've been banished. You should go to the Goths and raise an army.
And this is an example of a textual variant, because in the first folio, it says that Lavinia takes the hand in her teeth. And in the quarto, it says, take it between your arms. And that just happens because somebody either didn't have the right words when they were setting the type or couldn't read somebody's handwriting. There's a multiplicity of reasons why that could happen. The problem is, in performance, a director obviously has to choose, is she going to pick it up in her teeth or between her arms? If you have Lavinia pick up the hand between her teeth, without fail, the entire audience is going to laugh at it. And I think that's a very human reaction at this point, because what else do you do when presented with this? Like, there's a woman on stage who's been raped, her tongue's cut out, she doesn't have any hands. Titus has just chopped off his own hand to save his sons, and now his daughter has to carry the hand in her teeth. Like, how can you even begin to digest this as a human being? Like, how horrible this situation is. So we laugh.
Lucius acquiesces to his father's wishes and flees for the Goths. And there's an interesting historical note here. Some people might be questioning why in the world would Lucius flee to the Goths. Historically, the time period that Titus Andronicus is set in is the late Roman period, where you had the Eastern Empire and the Western Empire. And you also had a great many different tribes, from the Goths to the Vandals, all living in Roman territory. Very often, Roman politics was decided by who could acquire the largest number of Goth tribes on their side. So Lucius writing to the Goths is actually is not uncommon in Roman history. He would be going out to find the right Goth tribes who would be willing to stand up and support him and stand against Tamora's Goths. And that is the end of scene one. We move on to scene two, where we have the remaining Andronici sitting down for dinner. This is the first appearance of Lucius's son, referred to in the play as Young Lucius. Young Lucius, Titus, and Lavinia, and Marcus are sitting at the dinner table. Young Lucius attempts to cheer up Lavinia, and everyone else is also attempting to communicate with her. Titus, once again, believes he understands her best. During dinner, Marcus goes out and kills a fly, and we kind of see more of Titus's strain here, as Titus immediately berates Marcus for killing a fly. Marcus excuses himself because it was not just a fly. It was a black fly, like Aaron the Moor. Titus then says, oh, that is quite okay then, and joins in the slaughter of the, or the dismemberment, or the beating of the fly corpse.
This is the fly killing scene that I was talking about that we got in the folio version and was probably added between when the first quarto was published and when the folio was published. And you can really see why this happens. We see the whole Andronici family together, and Titus is really just trying to keep his, after this, these horrible things have occurred, he's really just trying to keep his family together. It's a family meal. Everyone's there. Titus is spoon-feeding Lavinia. It's actually pretty sweet and touching. And then we can also begin to see the seeds again of Titus losing it as he looks around and realizes, this is my family now, and this is what things are coming to. Also noteworthy, after this scene at the end of Act 3, it's where you're going to get your intermission in most modern performances.
So, and that is the end of Act 3.
Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Curses! Take 2000.